Welcome back to the program. Consider this, that the dust in our homes and our cars, even in our offices, contain particles from the cosmos. For hundreds, thousands, even millions of years, meteorites have struck Earth, pounding Earth, and shaping the planet. And they still do so today. We're going to talk about this morning with my guest, Christopher Kokinos. He's the author of the previous bestseller, Hope is the Thing with Feathers. He's the winner of the Writing Writers Award, the Glasgow Prize for Emerging Writers in Nonfiction. His work has appeared in numerous publications, including the Los Angeles Times, Science, and Poetry. He's a professor of English at Utah State University, and it is my pleasure to have him here to talk about his new book, The Fallen Sky, An Intimate History of Shooting Stars. Christopher Kokinos, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. How are you, Jeff?
First of all, one of the things you talk about early on in the book is that meteorites really represent both life and death for the planet. Talk about that.
Absolutely. One of the things that I found in researching the fallen sky was that, we talk about impacts, meteorites and Hollywood, we have this impression that they only get bad press, right, because they wiped out the dinosaurs and they're going to wipe out civilization and all of that. So, and that's important to realize. Those things have happened, and civilization is threatened by rocks from outer space. Although that isn't something I would put to, at the top of my worry list.
Mm-hmm.
But they also have brought to the planet, along with comets, 4.6 billion years ago, things like water, carbon, amino acids. And so the building blocks of life have arrived from outer space with these rocks that we normally associate with just death and destruction.
There's also this tremendous history as to how people have responded to meteorites, both in terms of superstition, in terms of fear, and in terms of scientific discovery.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I think the folklore that you allude to is just totally rich, beautiful stuff. Meteor showers pretending the end of the world. We just got through the Perseid meteor shower a week or so ago, and sometimes they were looked at as portending doom and the apocalypse. At the same time, meteorites, the rocks that actually arrive on the surface of the planet, meteors are the lights that we see in the sky, and meteorites are the rocks that sometimes survive to land on the planet. And in different cultures, from Native American cultures to Near Eastern and Asian cultures, have worshipped these stones. And so there's a rich, human association with these things. And as I worked on the book, I found that, these rocks, which are not actually terribly interesting to look at, they're just kind of rocks, but they have this rich history. They have secrets in them that tell us about the origins of the solar system, about life and death on this planet, and they tell us about our own desires, our own passions as people.
And while they are just rocks, there is a sense when one has one of touching history, that we don't know how old these rocks are necessarily, but some of them could be billions and billions of years old.
Oh, they are. They're quite ancient. They're primordial, and they arrive from the asteroid belt. They date to the origin of the solar system, so they're, about 4.6 billion years old. I have here on my desk right in front of me right now this meteorite that's called an ordinary chondrite. I think is kind of a funny name because we wouldn't think of a rock from space as ordinary, but it happens to be a fairly common form of meteorite, and it's this, it's this brown rock. But I'm also touching the skin of creation. So it's the oldest thing that you can ever hold in your hands. And this particular kind of meteorite is almost like holding a piece of the sun, because its chemical composition matches the sun's exactly, minus helium and hydrogen. So when you look at these things, they may not be visually all that intriguing, but just a little bit of factual, background, just a little bit of knowledge, a little bit of imagination about the scale of time and the cosmos, and you're holding something that can take you not only back to the origin of the solar system, but these rocks have in them bits of elements from other stars that exploded. So without mastering, warp drive and having command of the Enterprise, we can actually reach other star systems,
mm-hmm.
in a sense.
One of the things that you talk about is the long history of individuals that have chased these things, both for scientific gain and even for profit sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. And the book is really, The Fallen Sky is really structured around these amazing characters that I found out about. I started the book several years ago when I was living in Kansas, which I didn't know, and then found out it was a great place to hunt for meteorites. And I was like, well, why would that be? And meteorites fall all the time, and they don't fall with preference toward any part of the Earth. But a place like Kansas in, you know, the homesteading era in the late 19th century into the 20th century was a place where people were busting up the prairie. And so they're finding rocks. They're finding meteorites buried in the soil. And there was a farm wife in the 1880s whose husband kept finding these huge, black, ugly, heavy rocks on their farm. And, you know, he would just curse them, you know, because they would literally break his plow. She realized that they were meteorites. And after about 5 years, got some scientists from nearby universities to come down and look at these things. They were very rare. She had a huge cache of them, and she became the richest woman in the county. A fellow who stole a 15-ton meteorite and then lost it in court and then lost his marriage. The characters are really amazing, and it was a lot of fun to research their lives.
The idea of meteorite hunters is a fascinating notion.
Meteorite hunting is a pretty big subculture. There are several thousand people who collect meteorites. Well, and the only way you can collect them or buy them is if somebody's out there, right, getting them. Because even though they're landing all the time, they're not necessarily easy to find. And it turns out one of the characters I wrote about from Kansas was this obscure, small, wiry, nervous biology professor named Harvey Nininger, who in the 1920s pioneered this idea that you could actually go out and look for meteorites that had fallen from fireballs, or even to scour the countryside in places that hadn't been looked at for meteorites before. And this was against a great deal of skepticism, but it was a radical idea, and he was right, and you can do this. And to this day, professional dealers, just like fossil dealers or dinosaur hunters, they're professional hunters and dealers in meteorites, and they go around the world. From, you know, a suburb of Chicago where there was a meteorite shower a few years ago to the deserts of North Africa. They find these things, bring them out, donate samples of them to the scientific community, and then sell the rest for profit to make a living.
You talk about the early beliefs about meteorites, even going back to Aristotle, who believes that they were earthly vapors somehow,
right,
and the Chinese idea that they were sort of thrown off by the thunder gods. When did we get to the point that we understood them as having scientific value?
Well, it's an interesting story because the scientific community, the community of, you know, I guess what we would call then, or what they called themselves, natural philosophers in the 18th century and into the 19th century, were just starting to accept the idea that rocks would fall from the air and even potentially from outer space. But it took a while for that pivot to take place, and you know, the sort of ironic twist, some of the peasant beliefs were more accurate than the beliefs of natural philosophers, because some indigenous cultures understood that these were rocks that were coming from way up in the sky and landing on the earth, and sort of enlightenment skepticism said, well, that doesn't make any sense. That doesn't fit our paradigm of the cosmos. But at the end of the 18th century, there were a number of meteorite falls, fortunately of all of a similar type of meteorite, and some chemists in this new field of chemistry were analyzing these things and finding, well, this rock has some stuff in it that we don't see on Earth very often. Meteorites have a lot of nickel iron in them, relatively speaking, and that's rare on planet Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So that coincided with a fall in 1803 of thousands and thousands of meteorites on a village called Legla near Paris, and it was indisputable after that. You know, people then understood, yeah, these rocks are coming from the sky. They're not being blown out by volcanoes. And then it became a question of, okay, well, where are they coming from? Are they forming in the upper atmosphere? Are they coming from outer space? But that pivotal time around the turn of the century, around 1800, really started the scientific journey emphatically, which continues today. I mean, scientists are studying these rocks today for all sorts of interesting reasons.
One of the great turns was discovering that these meteorites could, in fact, be responsible for creating craters on the planet.
Yes, indeed, and that's an interesting classic debate, and in a way continues today. And the debate has always been between volcanoes causing these things, because that's what we had associated, you know, craters. In fact, that was the term was exclusively understood to be a volcanic feature. You know, calderas and craters are you know, at the tops of these volcanoes, and there was no sense that those would be associated with impacts from outer space. So even as scientists understood that rocks fell from space and had cratered the Earth in the past, there wasn't any sense that this would have happened recently. And so I tell the story of Daniel Berenger, who was a mining engineer, actually, not a geologist, although he was well-versed in the field. And he bought sight unseen what is now called Meteor Crater in Arizona, which I'd recommend people go visit if they haven't seen it. Spectacular and great museum. And the argument really was between a terrestrial explanation for this big hole in the ground and an impact. And Berenger was right. It was formed by an impact. But the scientific community was really reluctant to believe that impacts were that frequent, even into the middle of the 20th century. So although I think we are surprisingly accepting of this now, even as recent as the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, scientific community geologists were a little hesitant to believe that impacts were that common, but now we know they really are.
Mm-hmm. Thinking about it in terms of just popular culture, when did we get to the point that we looked fondly, positively, on meteorites, on falling stars?
Well, that's a good question. Think about, you know, Bruce Willis and Deep Impact and Armageddon and movies like
right.
that. And the relationship there doesn't seem to be one of fondness. It's more like, you know, we're going to go out and kick that asteroid's butt or something. A terrible idea, by the way. It's the science in those movies is really implausible. But I think the strand out of folklore that looked at these shooting stars, looking at the meteors, is something we wish on, you know, that they tell us about the fate of our lives. And then the worshiping of certain meteorites in certain cultures, that very positive sort of engagement with something alien, with something other, and believing that played a significant role in the life of a person or a culture, that's been there for a long time. And then now I think with all the bad press that meteorites have gotten because of the death and devastation that they rained on the dinosaurs and so on, I think the other part of that story is also getting out, which is, say, if the dinosaurs hadn't been, you know, pummeled to death by an asteroid or comet impact, mammals would not have evolved into those empty ecological niches. And so we have that big impact 65 million years ago to thank for our being here today. And one of the other stories I tell on the fallen sky is of much more controversial research that suggests that the Cambrian explosion, which was the first great diversification of species on planet Earth 500 million years ago, may have been related to a huge asteroid impact. So there is this side of them that I think we are starting to pay attention to.
Talk about the dangers that are also ascribed to meteors and asteroids in terms of bringing viruses, germs, plague.
Well, I don't think that's any, that's really not a concern. I mean, I think they have brought, you know, things like, as I said, carbon and water and amino acids and so forth. A very small minority of scientists. Fred Hoyle, I believe, the cosmologist and also science fiction writer, I've just read a couple of his science fiction novels, postulated this idea that various germs and plagues and so forth may have been brought to planet Earth from outer space, either, you know, from asteroids or from comets. It's dismissed by the mainstream scientific community, but on the flip side there, the threat of impacts is real, and I don't mean to sound, you know, trivializing of those. And so I mentioned Meteor Crater. That was formed by an object that was just 150 feet wide. So, you know, visualize a couple of mobile homes, you know, back-to-back, some couple of semi-trailers or so back-to-back. And not a big object, but it devastated an area of about 100 square miles. You know, anything within 100 miles of that impact was wiped out. And an event like that happens every couple centuries. So, you know, you can imagine what that would have done to a city. It was 50,000 years ago, but, you know, these things do occur. So I think paying attention to continuing to survey for potentially hazardous asteroids, not dismissing that, as a lot of politicians do, but understanding that there is a long-term threat to civilization from outer space, and we really ought to take it seriously.
In many ways, part of the fascination, part of the folklore, the mythology, and even the richness of the science fiction on this comes from, it seems, the idea that this is the one way that many people come the closest to the cosmos by either seeing or touching these meteors.
Yeah, oh, I think that's absolutely right. And for all of our scientific richness now, for our engagement with these things, you know, cracking them open in laboratories, slicing them and looking at them under, electron microscopes and all this very sophisticated analytical stuff, you know, and heck, I was an English major, so a lot of that stuff is kind of beyond me, and the science that I present in the book is, the science that an English major would understand. So, but for all of that, we have this emotional connection to these things. We stop when we're outside at night, if we're out, you know, under a dark enough sky, and we see a shooting star, we stop and we look at that because it's beautiful. And for some people, then it's this thing to wish upon. It does put us in touch with the larger cosmos. And as you said in your lovely introduction, I mean, this stuff is coming all the time. Cosmic dust is sifting down. It doesn't all just burn up. If it's small, it moves slowly. It can sift down to the planet. So dust on your furniture in your home, some of it is from outer space. So I think if you kind of widen your perspective that way and understand that it is around us. You don't necessarily have to go out and hunt a meteorite and find it and hold this big chunk of iron or stone in your hand, although that's pretty cool to do. It is coming down to our lives where we are right now, and it does put us in touch with, big scales and vast grandeur.
Tell us a little bit about your own personal experiences. You traveled extensively working on the falling sky. Some of the unique things that you saw along the way.
Well, it was quite an adventure. I mean, I started in Kansas and started in places like McPherson, Kansas, where this fellow Harvey Nininger, the naturalist who pioneered meteorite hunting, saw this big fireball. And I stood on a street corner in this small town in Kansas, and I was probably looked at by some of the neighbors who were cutting their lawns, thinking, well, why is that guy standing in a reverie on the street corner? And I went from places like that to Greenland, 600 miles north of the Arctic Circle, traveling by an open boat with some biologists, actually, who were doing falcon surveys. And they took me near to and then got me to an area on the northwest Greenland coast where Robert Peary, who the famous polar explorer, had discovered these iron meteorites and had them basically ripped out of the ground and shipped to New York, where you can see them today at the American Museum of Natural History. I remember vividly being dropped off at a place called Meteorite Island while the biologists went off on their boat to go look for birds, and they were giving me advice on how to shoot a polar bear if I happened to see one while I was there. Just stuff I didn't quite expect as I was looking into the subjects of meteorites and meteors. Went to Antarctica. The book concludes with my being part of a scientific expedition in Antarctica, where meteorite hunting done by the National Science Foundation teams is a huge enterprise and gleans thousands of meteorites for scientific study. So I traveled a lot, and it was pretty crazy at times.
Are you surprised? Are scientists surprised that we are not impacted by more meteorites in ways that have a profound effect on the planet?
No, as I got into the book, I learned about the various statistics of odds of things happening, how often a big impact would occur. We mentioned meteor crater, a larger impact, actually just over a century ago now, 100 years ago, in 1908, the impact that destroyed Tunguska, which is the Siberian forest. And again, people may know that impact. It's been featured on, various science documentaries a lot. That impact, that scale of impact occurs about every 500 years. And that devastated the equivalent of 20 Manhattan Islands. So I think, you know, scientists are paying attention to this, and I think the general public is paying attention to it, but it sometimes gets distorted, you know, in terms of a particular rock in space passing by. Maybe that's going to hit us, maybe it's not. And scientists need to be able to have a large sample size, in a sense, to understand the orbits of these things. And so there's some uncertainty there. The individual odds of being hit by a meteorite are really small. I mean, trillions to one. But, as we said, you know, there is a chance for larger scale impacts. And some of these objects come almost, you know, not quite literally, but seem to come out of nowhere. We don't know them. They're dark. They're in an eccentric orbit. And we do need to continue surveying and expand our surveys of the sky to know where these things are, and then actually plan some other ways of defending ourselves besides sending, you know, Bruce Willis up in a space shuttle. So, and there are ways. There are good ways to do this, but I'm not sure that politicians have quite decided that this is, you know, something that would or would not be laughed at by the general public.
What are some of the ways that scientists have seriously talked about?
Well, one way, first I'd say there's an interesting group of people called the B612 Foundation. It's headed by Rusty Schweikert, who's the former Apollo astronaut, and they are proposing altering the orbit of an asteroid in a controlled manner by sending an object out, a probe, and hovering that probe over an asteroid. And that seems, what would that do? Well, there's just enough mass and gravitational attraction from the smaller object, from the probe, that it would alter the orbit of the asteroid. There are other proposals to shine mirrors on them or somehow heat up one side of the surface, and that uneven heating would cause a change in the asteroid's orbit. But these things would take time. So again, knowing ahead of time where an object is, that would be necessary to enact some of these things. The problem with the Hollywood scenario of say, blowing it up into multiple other objects is you haven't really reduced the threat. Instead of one big object, you've got a bunch of other objects coming in, too, which would also do a lot of damage.
Right. But the assumption always is that somehow the smaller objects are going to be burned up coming in.
They do sometimes, yes, get burned up coming in. But I think the size, I can't remember how big those things are in those movies, but they're awfully big. You know, even after they get blown up, you know, that 150 foot wide meteoroid that came in and punched a hole in the ground and caused Meteor Crater, imagine a few thousand of those hitting the Earth. It would be pretty unpleasant, actually.
Christopher Kokinos. The book is The Fallen Sky, An Intimate History of Shooting Stars. It's just out from Torture Penguin. Christopher, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Get your falling star and put it in your pocket. Save it for a rainy day. For love may come and tap you on the shoulder some starless night. And just in case you feel you want to hold her, you'll have a pocket full of starlight.